Holcomb's billion-dollar infrastructure plan, new Donnelly Braun poll numbers, that plus Banks wants Trich to sashay away, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 7th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced he'll increase tolls to help pay for major infrastructure work.
Holcomb's plan will increase rates on the Indiana toll road by 35% for commercial trucks. Passenger vehicles won't be affected. That increase will generate $1 billion for the state, paid out over 3 years by the private company that runs the toll road. The state won't say how much it will generate for the private company. The money will go to various projects. The bulk is intended to help speed up completion of I-69 from Martinsville to Indianapolis. Other dollars will go towards trails, rural broadband, nonstop international flights into Indy, and highway projects.
Is hiking truck tolls the right way to pay for this plan? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Laura Beck, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette State House reporter Nikki Kelly. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Laura Beck, is this a good funding plan?
Well, it's a politically safe funding plan. It definitely is. I'll let Mike espouse on the merits of it, but it's politically safe from the perspective of you're raising taxes on someone who is not necessarily going to be as loud about it with the motor truck companies as maybe other folks would be. But at the same time, it's got to be done from his perspective, because you've got to fix I-69, you got to finish it. We're driving around in Indiana on our interstates, and we're still dodging potholes in September. So there's some work that has to be done here. So at this point in time and the timing of it, it makes sense from a political standpoint for him to do it.
Was this the politically safest way to pay for this plan?
We'll find out. I think before this, we had one of the best infrastructure programs in the country because of the package the legislature passed last year that raised gas taxes and invests now billions in a long-term infrastructure program. So Governor Holcomb really came up with another creative solution to try to leverage dollars that come from truck tolls for people that are passing through the state and using that road. The toll road company is reinvesting tens of millions of dollars as part of this deal back into that road. And then we get to do the trail program, finish I-69 3 years ahead of schedule, and a lot of other things. Increase broadband connectivity
but
across
the
state.
But raising the tolls on trucks does roll back down to the consumer in terms of the goods that those trucks are shipping, doesn't it?
Sure, but these financing programs, the fiscal conservative who hated the gas tax increase isn't going to like this either. But fiscal conservatism isn't just opposing any increase in taxes or tolls or things like this. It would be, in this situation, opposing broadband or opposing fixing roads or opposing finishing I-69, because the government only pays for things one of two ways. They either incur debt, which has been the Democrats' program, transportation program over the years, in response to things like this, or you pay cash. Indiana's been in a very good fiscal situation because of our conservatism in cutting taxes 18 different ways over the last 16 years and increasing them where we need to, where we all agree we need to invest.
Now, one of the things that this does, you both mentioned, is speeding up the I-69 completion by 3 years. That's the goal anyway. Now, that would be in 2024, which would be at the end of his potential second term in office. So I suppose there's not a lot of risk for him personally.
Just name it after him.
But is there, as someone who drives that route pretty regularly, John Schwannis,
yes,
is there any risk to Republicans in general at another promise that might not be fulfilled?
Probably not so much threat there as the damage that already was done by the failure to meet the deadlines that had been offered in the past. And I do say that as the father of two IU students who are on the other end of the rainbow, or on the other end of Highway 37 or 69. Someday I'll get there. And so I'll be cheering along with everyone else. I think this makes sense politically. I think both folks who have spoken thus far made good points. It looks ambitious. It looks as if here's somebody who has a plan. It's not just, I think I want to do this, but I'm not sure how I'm going to fund it. He comes in with an idea of how to fund it. It's something that people can appreciate and understand, those who are motorists, which is about everybody either is driving or riding in a car to get from point A to point B. So it's not esoteric. It's something that's very tangible. And we've in recent weeks have talked about, you know, agendas that are filled with red meat, you know, political red meat and social issues versus the brick and mortar, or in this case, asphalt and concrete projects. And I think that's what, it's the latter that Hoosiers tend to like in their governors. And so it ain't sexy, but it's the kind of thing I think that resonates with voters, and the mechanism for paying for it is, while it will not satisfy everyone, nothing does, it is the best choice from in the eyes of voters, I think.
If you were grading this plan, however, you might have to give it an incomplete at this point, because there's a big piece of information that we don't know the answer to, and Nikki, you've talked about this and reported on this, which is, how much is the company getting?
We don't know that, and I understand that it's a private company, and you know they don't want to release their revenue numbers or projections, but you know I do think it's a little hard for Hoosiers to have an idea. Is it a good deal? Yeah, we're getting $1 billion, and here's what we're going to put it into, but we don't know what, you know, what Hoosiers are going to pay for that. And yes, many drive on the road are outside of Indiana, but some are inside of Indiana too, and this does impact more than just a semi, you know. So we asked the governor about that, and their answer was, well, we did this third-party independent assessment, which is great. He needed a third-party assessment to show whether it was a good deal. I'm just asking to see the same thing.
You know, it's worth remembering that when we first leased the toll road, tolls were capped. Tolls were frozen. Then they were capped on increases based on the consumer price index. And so there were protections put into place here to not allow a private company just come in and start jacking the tolls, and which was actually what caused the problem to begin with the toll road, because it cost 40 cents to collect a quarter, you know, because we just didn't have the political will to raise those tolls in a way that was sustainable and reflected the actual costs on the road.
All right. Well, an NBC Marist poll of Indiana's Senate race this week shows Joe Donnelly with a lead over Mike Braun, but that lead shrinks with the addition of Libertarian Lucy Brenton.
The poll surveyed about 1,000 Hoosier adults, about 800 of whom were registered voters, and about 500 of them who were likely to vote. The results showed Donnelly with a 6-point lead over Braun in a 2-person race, but when the pollster added in Libertarian Lucy Brenton, Donnelly's lead shrunk to just 3 points. 8% of those surveyed say they'd cast their ballot for Brenton, who also ran for Senate in 2016. Donnelly is outperforming Braun among minorities, independent voters, and white college graduates. Braun has the edge among white non-college graduates, evangelical voters, and those in the suburban donut counties around Indianapolis.
Mike O'Brien, we haven't talked much on this show about Libertarian Lucy Brenton's impact in this race, as this poll clearly shows some impact. Could she play the spoiler here for one of these two candidates?
Yeah, I think this poll was smart in that it ran the three-person race, pulled the three-person race, then ran a head-to-head so you could see what the difference was. 8's pretty high for a Libertarian in a U.S. Senate race, but it's also a Secretary of State's year where they need to come out, Libertarians need to show up, and at a higher rate than they normally would to maintain their party status in that Secretary of State race.
So
they can get on the ballot and have that ballot access. So, yeah, I thought this poll was pretty good. We all kind of knew it was tight. It's tight. It's within the margin, right? Donald Trump's still more popular than not.
Just by that much.
Which you would expect in the kind of environment we're in, where you've got tens of millions of dollars being fired at people. The issues kind of rolled out, healthcare, the economy, as the top tier issues.
Immigration.
Right. So, and that's what we've seen from both sides. We see Joe Donnelly embracing Donald Trump's immigration plan, and it's all kind of going according to the way this poll kind of laid it out.
If you're Joe Donnelly, are you worried about the impact Lucy Brenton seems to be having in this race?
I don't think so. I think at this point, Joe Donnelly just needs to keep doing what he's doing. And I think that he is, because he's his own man, because he works in a bipartisan way, because he does reach across the aisle and takes in all viewpoints into account, I think that's one of the reasons why people like him. To me, the most surprising part is that Braun has really not surged at all. I would think that after the primary, he would have had a little bit of a bump and kept moving forward with that. But it almost feels like to me that he set out to win the primary and then really didn't have the game plan ahead to move forward. So I feel like he's lost some wind behind his back. And so that puts Donnelly in a really strong position moving into to Election Day.
43 is a pretty tough number for an incumbent. Well, U.S. Senator.
You can say that all you want, and we'll talk to Senator Donnelly on election night. Yeah, we'll talk to him on election night.
Conventional wisdom often has the libertarian votes, if you will, if they are being drawn away from one of the two major parties, usually has them being drawn away from a Republican, but here they seem to be drawing away mostly from the Democrat. Does that maybe worry Joe Donnelly a bit?
A little, largely because I think Joe Donnelly knows he's not going to pick up, you know, Republican-based supporters. He is looking for the libertarian, the moderate, the middle-of-the-road person. So if some of those are instead going to Lucy Brittenden, I mean, he should be a little bit concerned about that.
Though, I mean, everybody kind of got the sense that this was going to be tight through November. It's clearly tight in this poll, though. If you're Joe Donnelly, are you just happy enough that, albeit tight, you have the lead?
I don't know if happy. I think there's a certain sense of relief. I think there seemed to be some headwinds that he was facing during during the primary season, where Mike Braun was ubiquitous. You know, the spots were everywhere. There seemed to be some momentum. And the question, of course, was would the Republicans who had supported his opponents in the primary rally around behind him? Whether that's happening or not, I don't know. But it does. There's a sense that, you know, the best shot was taken in the primary, and now it's sort of settling back to what I would expect. Now, clearly, a third-party candidate can have an impact. I mean, just ask President Gore how that whole Ralph Nader Florida thing went. There are lots of examples like that where it actually tipped the scales in a very clear-cut, dramatic fashion. So you can't discount that. I would agree, though, that it'll settle back from that percentage once we see voters go to the polls.
The other part, too, I think, though, we always have to consider here, too, is we don't know what Donald Trump is going to do between now and Election Day. And
we also don't know what Joe Donnelly is going to do.
He is going to do a lot. Right, he is going to do a lot. We don't know.
The Supreme Court picks a big deal.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Libertarian candidate Lucy Brittenden make an impact in the U.S. Senate race? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, does the Indiana Chamber's decision not to endorse in the U.S. Senate race hurt the candidates? 53% say it hurts Mike Braun, just 9% say it hurts Joe Donnelly, 7% say it hurts both, and 31% say it won't really make a difference. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Congressman Jim Banks' campaign this week threatened to file an ethics complaint against Democratic challenger Courtney Tritch over a drag-themed fundraising event.
The Tritch campaign billed the event as the Queen's Court. Campaigning is a drag. Held at a nightclub in Fort Wayne, it featured drag queens and kings promoting the Northeast Indiana Democrat. The Banks campaign objected, reportedly sending a video to the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette that showed Tritch dancing on stage and in the audience, collecting paper bills from attendees. The Banks camp alleges a campaign finance violation, but federal election law doesn't require campaigns to collect personal information from donors who give less than $50. The Tritch campaign fired back at Banks, accusing him of homophobia.
Nikki Kelly, I asked a similar question when we talked about these campaigns a few weeks ago, which is, in everybody expects to be a very safe Republican seat up there. Why is the Banks campaign engaging so much on some of this stuff?
I do think Courtney Tritch is running an okay campaign, and she's getting some attention up there, so that might be part of it. I honestly do think that it was just a look that he didn't think was a smart move. I mean, to have any candidate at any event, regardless of the backdrop of what the fundraiser was, being showered with money, I think he did not think it was a very good look. And to be fair, though, you know, no complaint has been filed. We're weeks away from the reporting on this specific event, so we'll see how she handles it to make sure she follows the correct rules.
Yeah, is it one of those things where it's probably not an actual campaign finance violation, but it sure don't look good?
I'm virtually certain it's not a campaign finance violation. I mean, maybe, no, I don't think there's any question about that. As far as does it look good, classic case of it's in the eye of the beholder. Now, clearly, Jim Banks is banking on the fact that this would be disturbing in some fashion to his constituency. But other candidates have done this in districts. I think Joe Hogsett did a fundraiser like this here in Indianapolis. Others have done it around the country. Again, know your audience. Know what your constituency is and what your base is. And maybe her sense is that this plays to that as a distinguishing factor. It does surprise me that again and again we see an acknowledgement of the upstart or the challenger, which again runs against conventional wisdom, but it may be one, an insurance policy just to make sure people, you know, that's product A, this is product B, you know, don't mix this up, and to make sure that the base on some of these family social issues
really
is, gets
I
people
think,
revved up a little bit.
It's just reminding people in a race where Jim Banks is seen as such the safe, you know, bet, to remind his base, we still need to get you out and vote.
Yeah. Nikki said regardless of the scenario, like the theme of the fundraising event, but how much does the theme of the fundraising event play into the reason why Jim Banks decided to go after this?
I don't think that's Congressman Banks. I know that's not Congressman Banks' motivation on this. This is like a terrible absent judgment. I mean, the answer to having money thrown at you at a fundraiser, like literally throw it, one, it's hard to audit this for campaign finance purposes. And her answer is, well, I didn't exceed the minimum cash donation limits. It's every part of this was a terrible lapse in judgment.
Yeah, was the homophobia accusation a little far for what they were talking about?
Do we have LGBT groups coming out and like saying
I don't think it all is at all. And what I found fascinating about his response is that it was not surprising to me, because when she hammered him on debates, which he won't debate her, his spokesman's response was, well, he's not going to debate her because he has a job and a family, which is probably one of the most patronizing things you can possibly say to a professional woman candidate or any woman candidate running. So that didn't surprise me from that perspective. And on this one, I think it is a case of she was doing a fundraiser and having fun. And so those could be counted as small dollar donations. He's not going to have a lot of small dollar donations because he's funded by corporations and PACs. So what you have to be cognizant here for him is when he comes out and gets all worked up about these kind of things, that's going to also motivate other people to come out and vote for her. So it could have the adverse effect.
Just saying, if this, I guess a rhetorical question, if this had been not a drag theme but say a faux tent revival, with some preacher up there, and they had passed the collection plate. I don't think there would have been necessarily.
It's the Republican equivalent to like doing this at a country club and having a bunch of like white based Republicans throwing cash at you while you're standing in the bar. We would never do that.
Because they would write checks. I mean, that's not the cash thing.
Moving on, Federal Communications Commission leader Brendan Carr was in Indy this week to tout Indiana's efforts to lead on 5G internet connectivity. Access that requires smaller technology.
The FCC's proposal would build infrastructure for wireless internet access, but Carr's plan would also bar local governments from prohibiting wireless deployment and set deadlines for municipalities to approve or disapprove applications. Wireless 5G technology only requires small boxes, but requires more of them, especially in urban areas, because the signals degrade over a much shorter distance. Local officials want the technology, but worry about allowing telecommunication companies to deploy it however and wherever they see fit. State lawmakers this year passed legislation designed to limit local control of small cell wireless infrastructure.
John Schwannis, I don't think anybody would argue that better connectivity is good, but, and this is a debate that Indiana has been having for a couple of years now, is that connectivity coming at the cost of local control?
I would just say first, don't follow kids, dog acts, or animal acts, or anything else in show business, or drag queen topics on this show. So I'll take one for the team, though, and bring it down a notch or two. Clearly, the issue here is, I think you're correct. I mean, there is the technological issue, which I can live to 100. I'll never fully understand what it all means. And then there's the local control issue, which is an issue, some would say problem, nationally. The National League of Cities has declared this the era of legislative preemption, and they have put forth a survival guide, as they call it, for municipalities to deal with these things. When you think about Indiana, this is just a bit of a pattern. You had when Bloomington a few years ago was toying with the idea of banning plastic bags at the grocery line, there was a preemption. You look at Airbnb and Carmel's efforts to police non-hotel accommodations, same sort of thing. Same thing with local ordinances dealing with gender, with gay rights and alternative lifestyles. So this is a pattern. And it's not one that's going to be, it's broader than this issue, and it will live longer than this issue.
Yeah, I mean, Carr talked about Indiana as perhaps a lodestar on connectivity, and that's why it's coming to Indiana like this. But is every local community really happy at how Indiana's taking the lead here?
I honestly don't think that your John Q. Public has any idea about the internal regulations involving, I mean, all they want to know is that their computer runs fast and my right. phone gets 5G. I don't think they care who's regulating what. I really don't, as long as they're getting the service that is important to them.
Is this one of those where the end justifies the means? As long as my bars are full, it doesn't matter how you get there.
Well, I think as Hoosiers, yes, that is what we're going to care about. I think, though, where it does become an issue is where you put some of these the infrastructure, right? So where is that located? We also are well known in our state for being not in my backyard kind of folks as well. So then it becomes a real local control question where the technology is situated, how it's situated, how it's regulated. So
yeah, when we talk about quality of place being the new thing in economic development mm-hmm. and trying to beautify our spaces right. as much as possible, mm-hmm. does this work a little bit counter to that?
It can. That's been the argument, right? So, but I mean, you go down, walk around downtown. I mean, there are parts of downtown that are beautiful, and it's there's beautification on the sidewalks with potted plants and things, and then there's a 5G right. tower cool. attached yeah. to a mm-hmm. streetlight. Well, the streetlight's not aesthetic, but I understand the purpose for it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, from a preemption standpoint, I think you take John had a kind of a laundry list of things, and I think you take them case by case. I think in this for infrastructure, it's hard to say everybody go do your own thing. Because I-69 would be a dirt road through Bloomington and a 4-lane paved highway through Martinsville.
Well,
you know, I mean, so
it lately.
I mean,
I think for certain
plan?
Things, like, I mean, you have to have national standards for what a federal interstate looks like. You have to have state standards for what a state highway looks like. This is infrastructure that needs to be consistent across the state.
Well, Indiana Department of Education officials this week announced they'll seek damages from the company responsible for administering the statewide standardized test, ISTEP.
On state board meetings, State Department of Ed told members up to 22,000 students could be impacted by a problem with a 10th grade math question. The department says likely only a small percent of students are impacted by another scoring issue for students across multiple grade levels. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick says IDOE plans to ask testing service Pearson to pay for its trouble. Its contract with the state allows for daily damages between $50,000 and $150,000, but McCormick said the full impact won't be known until results are finalized.
Laura Beck, this is not the first time we've seen a problem like this. It seems like an annual occurrence at this point. So how much longer will Indiana have to suffer through these sorts of problems?
I don't know. I wish I had a crystal ball to say it would be over. I think that one of the big challenges is that this is an issue that spans administrations, it's an issue that spans elected officials, it's an issue that spans state boards and legislators. And so I think, though, one of the biggest challenges is that school funding and grading and teacher pay and school ratings all are based on the results of this ISTEP test. And so when you're doing that, you can have flawed data and flawed information. I mean, I even know at my son's school last year, we got an email saying, oh, so-and-so's had to retake the test, a number of kids, because the infrastructure didn't work with it. So it's not uncommon. And I think that's one of the reasons why people don't have confidence in the ISTEP. And I think you're seeing a lot of schools even move toward growth models like the NWEA, where you can actually see a more reliable measure of your growth rather than just the score that really doesn't compare, give you a lot of good information.
This is a high-stakes test, as she just talked about, with so many things dependent on the scores of this test. So we're already putting a lot of pressure on kids in that regard. How much worse does it make it when we keep having year after year, well, you're going to take this test and maybe it'll work?
I think, we haven't had the type of problems that we had, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not trying to make this a partisan because we've had problems with it for a long time, but it's a big, complex test that's taken by hundreds of thousands of people, and it's graded. And it's important to have processes in place when the data is questionable that you can go correct it, and that the state is made whole like they are in this situation,
hopefully.
And that there's an incentive for the testing company to get it right because they have these substantial penalties in front of them.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally, action this weekend at the Speedway. We hope, though the rain may tell a different story, with the Brickyard 400 at stake are the final two slots in the NASCAR Cup playoffs. It is prediction time. So we'll start with you, Mike O'Brien. Who have you got?
I like Brad Kozlowski, and I think there's a bunch of guys sitting on the cut line right now that, like, that are pretty good drivers, so it could be interesting. These guys trying to get into the
if they actually race.
But I like that they moved. I like that they moved the race and made it important. It's now a 3-stage race in the NASCAR's new format. So the Brickyard's going to be a different race than it's been in the past. So if you didn't go in the past or you thought it was boring, I think it's going to be a fun new deal.
What do you got?
I'm actually out this weekend with my 56 CYO Catholic football, so I'll be focused on that all day Sunday. So I'm going to cede my
time. I'm hoping
time
for the race.
John Schwannis.
Right. I'm traveling on Sunday. I'm hoping for rain out. I can come back
and
watch it
go
Monday.
Yeah. One of the Bush brothers. It's either going to be Kurt or Kyle Busch.
That's reliable.
But yeah. Ryan Newman.
You stole one of mine. I was going with Kyle Busch this weekend. So that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Lara Beck, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, as a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.